Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040138, Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee versus American Home Assurance Company, Inc. and the Travelers Indemnity Company. 040332, Bed Bath & Beyond versus Rafael Urista from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. And docket number 040429, Lexington Insurance Company and others versus Carol Keaton Strayhorn, Comptroller of Public Accounts of the State of Texas, and Greg Abbott, Attorney General of the State of Texas, from Travis County in the Third Court of Appeals District. I am not sitting in that final case. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument now in number 040138, Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee versus American Home Assurance Company and the Travelers Indemnity Company.
May it please the court, Mr. David Helton will hear argument of the court. Commissioners will reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal.
If it pleases the court, I am here today with Mark Tyser, who is a member of the Dallas Subcommittee of the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee. Mark tried the case in the court below, is also have been responsible for the factual presentation on appeal. Your Honor, I want to start by telling you what I think this case is about, what the committee thinks this case is about. It's not about the protection of lawyers. It is for the protection of the public against the corporate practice of law by lawyers who, by nature of their employment, have divided loyalty. The parties pretty much agree what the issues are in this case, and they're relatively straightforward. First, whether the insurance company's use of employee lawyers to render legal services not to the corporation but to third parties is the unauthorized practice of law. Second, whether an insurance defense lawyer, whether outside counsel or staff counsel, represents one client, the policyholder, or represents two clients, the policyholder and the insurance company as well. There are some collateral issues to this as well. One I think is important to note up front, and it is the issue of whether the UPLC as a governmental entity and a committee of this court has immunity from legal fees that were assessed by the Court of Appeals, not the trial court. That issue has been conceded by the insurance companies, but will require a change in the Eastland Court of Appeals opinion. The final issue is whether the use of firm names that in no way give rise to the idea that lawyers are practicing for the insurance company or are employees of the insurance company are misleading and violate 7.01 of the professional code. Let me address the first issue because I think it is the most compelling issue before the court, and that is whether the statutory framework in Texas prevents the use by a corporation of lawyer employees to render legal services, again, to third parties, not to the corporation itself, but to third parties. In our brief, you'll see that we rely on three separate statutes, the most important one being the Texas Business Corporation Act, Section 2.01B. That provides that a company cannot be authorized to do business or even chartered in the state of Texas if it want any one of its purposes, not the main purpose, any one of its purposes is to provide any kind of service that requires a license not available to a corporation. We know under Chapter 81 of the Texas Government Code what has been known by as the State Bar Act, that only a member of the State Bar of Texas can receive a license to practice law, and only a person who has a license to practice law can render legal services, again, on behalf of a client. In fact, 81.101, which both parties rely on, is very specific that the practice of providing legal services, again, to a third party on behalf of a client is what is prohibited to be done by a corporation or anyone who doesn't have a law license.
The Court of Appeals says that the company is not organized, an insurance company is not organized to practice law. And what's your response to that?
Your Honor, twofold. First off, and I think most importantly, I think the court misread the statute. Remember, what the statute says, any one of the purposes for which the company is acting. Equally as important, we know as a matter of law that they do provide legal services. We always have known that. This court in the Farmers case that we cited to you has held that the business of insurance in Texas with a standard policy is twofold, duty to indemnify and duty to provide a legal defense. Actually, we also know this because the standardized policies, which our insurance friends rely on, are very specific that they have a duty to indemnify and provide a legal representation. What our position is and where we think the Eastland Court of Appeals missed this is, the duty to defend is not collateral. And think about this. In Texas, where we have minimum liability policies in automobile cases, which is a requirement, by the way, to drive a car legally, all you have to have is $25,000 in coverage. The duty to defend may greatly exceed the duty, the insurance company's duty to indemnify. So I just don't think that issue works. The other thing he said, Your Honor, and you bring up a good point, but the other thing he says is, listen, outside counsel and staff counsel are both agents of the insurance company, and as such, they're the same. And there is no meaningful distinction between the two in the statutory framework. Not true. And I think it's legally not true by this court's decision. In Traver, State Farm versus Traver, the insurance industry, particularly State Farm, the insurance industry lobbied for an exemption for liability for outside lawyers' conduct. In other words, the insurance company wouldn't be liable for what the insurance company's outside lawyer did in a particular issue. This court agreed with them, and correctly so, noting that an outside lawyer is an independent contractor who owes a duty solely to the insured, and as a result, an insurance company could not be held vicariously liable.
Well, the possibility of conflict is what drives a lot of the analysis.
Yes.
And so what if you have a situation where there really is no possibility of a real conflict? No reservation of rights letter has been issued, and the insurer agrees to defend unqualifiedly, no reservation. Where is a conflict of interest there? Where's the harm?
Your Honor, two things. And first, let me say, you are right. There could be issues in which no conflict arises. In those issues, the insurance companies would have to handle their business differently than they do in this case under Code of Professional Responsibility 1.06, because they're not even informing the customer or their clients.
Okay, but putting that issue
putting
aside.
That aside, I would think that there is less of a problem in the unauthorized practice of law. I have to admit that because in other states you will see they limit in terms of unauthorized practice of law and unethical behavior into issues in which there can be no excess liability, in which there can be no reservations of rights and the like. So in that case we have a less problematic situation. But all of those courts, Your Honor, and I think this is terribly important to the courts look at this, every state that has looked at it, every ethics opinion that is the appendix that you got from the insurance company earlier this week, say one thing. This is a situation that is rife with conflicts. Rife is a used word that is used throughout these things. Or another one, chock full of potential conflicts. And conflicts that are not on the surface of the situation.
But by the same token, almost all those opinions say that it is allowed to some extent.
It is allowed to some extent based on a number of things, sometimes on statutes, sometimes on the basis that if there's any conflict whatsoever, it is not the authorized practice of law and it is unethical.
So you'd be comfortable with the rule that said as long as there's no reservation of rights letter, issued, then staff counsel would not be the unauthorized president.
I don't think you can draw the line that thinly, and here's why. Let me tell you that we would be more comfortable than what the present law is in the Eastland Court of Appeals opinion if there were no conflict whatsoever. But the reservation of rights letter doesn't determine this issue because conflicts come later on in the representation. Additionally, the control the insurance company exercises is terribly important. In this case, there are some disputed facts, I have to admit. But I will tell you this, one thing that's not disputed is about the Stowers issue and how the Catherine Woodruff firm handles those. Those are not in any of the guidelines. Those are in emails we have in which Ms. Woodruff informs everybody in her operation that we are going to follow these procedures, and here's what they are. Remember, when you're into a Stowers situation, which doesn't arise at first, can, but usually it arises deep in the litigation, here's what they have to do. Let me shock you.
Mr. Kelvin, before you go into that, who has established the procedures you're about to tell us about?
This was established by the insurance company American Home.
And who has the right to establish those procedures in the final analysis? Lawyers or non-lawyers?
I think it must be the lawyers.
In the company. Who in the company?
In the company, this was the company itself.
I know, but is it the board of directors?
No.
Legal counsel? Who finally controls the processes and procedures that the company employee lawyers use?
There is no real evidence in this record of who does that.
In a corporation.
But in a corporation, it's going to have to be the corporate body, and anybody within the corporate framework is acting on behalf of the corporation. The reason we're so upset with the committee about this is, remember, when Stowers arises, when you have that right, what occurs is you're in conflict already. The policyholder is going to be in potential conflict with the insurance company.
Well, now, how's that any different if you have a law firm that's, pick any law firm in the city of Houston, that does primarily insurance defense work? They're not a captive company owned by an insurance company, but they're out there on their own, been on their own forever, and they do primarily insurance work for, let's say, a reduced fee because they get such a big volume of work. At the end of the day, it's the insurance carrier that still calls the shots. It's the insurance carrier that has approved all the invoices, has come up with a litigation plan, and that law firm can't work outside that litigation plan without the approval of the insurance company. That's inherently the same type of conflict that you have with a captive insurance. Now, set aside the issues whether or not captive insurance carrier law firm can work because it's a business corporation. Isn't it the same type of conflict?
Your Honor, I don't believe it is for two reasons. But first, let me answer your question in two ways. First of all, that's not the facts of this case. The Catherine Woodruff emails on this were solely in-house counsel, not for outside counsel. And it's very specific about what they might do. Very quickly, what they are is they got to even notify the insurer or the insurance company that a Stowers demand is about to come before they can write the letter. They can't even tell the insurer, the policyholder, in writing about their Stowers right. Real quickly, the answer to that by the other side, and then I'll get to the second part of your question. The answer to from the insurance companies is, well, only a plaintiff can establish a Stowers right, never a defendant. Well, this court's opinion in Frank Casey in July, says that's not right. And obviously, it is a tool in the quiver of a policyholder. Justice Medina, in answer to the second part of your question, here's what I think the answer is. I think there is a significant difference between staff counsel and outside counsel when you are dealing with the issue of whether they bend to the will of an insurance company improperly. First, the insurance companies admit it. They admit it because what they say, what the testimony in this case is, if something comes up and if there is a conflict, if there's a reservation of rights letter that they think is serious enough to impact coverage, you know what they do? they refer it to an outside lawyer, not of the policyholder's choice.
Mr. Kellner, can you you're close to wrapping up. The time's expired.
Right. Yes, and finally, the one last answer to this is there's a difference of degree in being closer. There's also, we can discipline a law firm for which a lawyer works under 5.02. The Texas Commission can do that. We cannot discipline an insurance company. And equally as important, the insurance commission is not controlling that practice. They're looking at this court to do that. That's why it's so important it's the unauthorized practice.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Darsanio, Mr. Tom Wright will present argument for a respondent. Mr. Bill Darsanio will open the first sentence.
May it please the court. I'm going to start by talking about the fact that there's no error in the Court of Appeals judgment in this case. The procedural posture of the case is important. There wasn't a trial. This was a case that was litigated on the basis of dueling summary judgment motions, with the UPLC arguing the legal point that the use of staff counsel to represent policyholders is the unauthorized practice of law, period, under all circumstances and under all conditions. The insurers sought a summary judgment reaching the opposite conclusion. Nobody argued that there were fact issues that would need to be determined or anything that would need to be tried. In the trial court, the UPLC prevailed. As it happens on occasion, the losing summary judgment moving in the trial court wins in the Court of Appeals. There's nothing wrong with that judgment because I think, as even has been conceded here, perhaps not completely, it's not per se the unauthorized practice of law for insurers to use staff counsel to represent policyholders. Now, with respect to why the Court of Appeals opinion should be affirmed and why the ruling by the Court of Appeals that there was no unauthorized practice of law and no ethical violations committed, there are several points that we wish to make here today. The first point is that none of the statutes expressly or impliedly support the conclusion that the use of staff counsel to represent policyholders is an unauthorized practice of law. There's no statutory language to that effect. I'll come back to that in a moment.
So you agree with the Court of Appeals analysis of 201B?
Your Honor, we agree with the Court of Appeals analysis, but the more simple point is that policy holders are entitled to have a defense provided by liability insurance companies, but the liability insurance companies provide that defense through the selection of counsel of their choice. The lawyers conduct the defense. The lawyers are practicing law. The insurance companies are in the insurance business. They sell liability insurance policies. The policies give them the right and the responsibility to provide a defense through providing lawyers, inside counsel or outside counsel. The suggestion that the insurance companies are practicing law because their employees are practicing law is not something that the statute requires.
Well, how
it doesn't make any sense.
But how is it that the phrase any one or more of its purposes would not apply to the practice of law, to the
The purpose of a liability insurance company is to provide insurance benefits under the policy. The primary benefit is the indemnity obligation. It is the case that the defense obligation is collateral to the provision of that indemnity obligation. That doesn't mean that it's unimportant, and that's not what the Court of Appeals said. It also does not mean that when the insurers are providing a defense in fulfillment of their policy obligation by having lawyers conduct a defense, that the insurers are practicing law without a law license.
It's just as important for an insured to have a policy that says if I get sued, whether there's liability or not, then I'm going to be defended. Why isn't that a primary purpose of the policy as well?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that is a primary purpose, but it's still collateral to the defense obligation.
But isn't it the most significant purpose? Because if there's no indemnity unless there's There's no defense unless there's an obligation for indemnity.
Both obligations are significant. But if there is no indemnity obligation, there's no defense obligation either.
And then who does this lawyer serve? I mean, you can't have two masters. You can't serve the client and then be expected to protect
Honor,
the shares. Excuse me. Be expected to protect the shares of this corporation that you work for. There's a dual obligation here.
This court's precedent from Tilly forward makes the clear point that the insurance defense counsel's obligation is to owe and to fulfill a duty of unqualified loyalty to the insurer. That comes through from Tilly, through Traver, and through Davalos.
An employee has duties to its employer, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. An employee has duties to its employer.
Are you saying that as bankers? Are you saying that goes away when there's lawyers who are the employees?
I'm saying, Your Honor, and our briefs say this, and I think the UPLC concedes this point in their reply brief. I'm saying that the duty that an employee owes to an employer, when we're talking about a professional employee, does not allow the employer to interfere with the exercise of the employee's independent professional judgment. This court, several courts of appeals opinions, and more importantly, this court's opinion in Johnson versus Brewer and Pritchard make it plain that the responsibility to the client trumps the responsibility to an employer, even in a case where that means that the employer law firm would lose the lucrative legal business that was sent elsewhere in the interest of the client.
So it sounds like you're acknowledging that staff counsel does have responsibilities to the employer, but also responsibilities to the client. You're just saying the latter trumps the former.
Yes, and
not saying there aren't responsibilities in both directions.
This court's opinions say that. Now, when it gets down to Traver, this court said the insurance company has the right to control the defense as long as there's no conflict. Davalos talks about what a conflict is, and Mr. Wright will go into that in more detail. But the main point here is that the principal obligation is owed to the insured. The Eastland Court of Appeals said that client is the primary client, if you want to think of there being two clients, which is not necessary. And in virtually all of the cases that are involved in our record and the circumstances in our record, there is not a problem with serving two masters because there isn't a conflict.
Well, and that's the whole point, it seems to me, is at what point does that conflict disallow the sort of control that a corporation would appear to assert? And we can argue over the degree of control that happens outside counsel versus staff counsel. And I do think there's some appearance that when someone's an employee, there is more of an aspect of control, especially with the guidelines or some of the things that have been mentioned here today. But if we were to try to draft a rule that said it's okay in these circumstances as long as there's no possibility of conflict, but if there's possibility of conflict, it's the unauthorized practice of law, where would you draw that line?
Well, several answers to your question, Your Honor. I think the possibility of a conflict is the reality of litigation where multiple clients are represented or where multiple interests are represented. So it's not the possibility of a conflict that needs to be the standard. The standard needs to be whether there is a conflict. Now, the difficulty is in deciding what that means. This court's opinion in Davalos does a pretty good job of saying that there's a conflict when what would be litigated in the underlying case would have the possibility of affecting or impairing the indemnity obligation. That's the primary point. When the case is defended under a reservation of rights, there's not automatically a conflict. There's a conflict under those circumstances when the litigation of the first case would affect the outcome of the second case,
case. You would agree then that would be an improper use of staff counsel?
Yes.
Okay, because there was some indication in the briefs that, well, sometimes it might be, sometimes it might not be. But you agree that if the underlying facts to determine coverage are the same, that there would be a conflict?
Yes. Well, I think there are more details about that. I think under Texas case law, the first ruling would not have preclusive effect in the second case, but those are details. The main point is if there's a coverage issue that's litigated in the underlying case, then there would be a conflict, and there would be the need for withdrawal or some other resolution.
Even if there's a conflict, does that make it the unauthorized practice?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for asking me that. It wouldn't make it the unauthorized practice of law. We're acting here as if the unauthorized practice of law standard is identical to the difficult or complicated, at least ethical, questions. And under this court's holding in Hexford Title.
Let me ask you about this. One of the standards seems to me for trying to get at unauthorized practice as opposed to all these ethical problems is control. Do you think there's any more control when over staff attorneys than there is over outside counsel, whatever that level is, whatever Traver means and whatever professional judgment the lawyer's supposed to use and wherever he owes his duties, is it different outside and inside?
No, Your Honor. Certainly not under this record.
It looks different.
Well, the UPLC says, well, on the basis of common sense, it's different. They say that because they don't have any evidence that it's different. And there isn't any different standard that this court has announced for professional employees who are on the payroll in that sense, and lawyers who are independently responsible to exercise legal judgment on behalf of their clients.
The Stowers situation is different. I mean, if it's outside counsel, I don't think they have to get corporate permission to send a Stowers letter to the insurer.
There's also a difference, I mean, for those who practice insurance defense. I mean, you have a number of clients, you know, a number of insurers that you represent. You're not dependent. I mean, there may be some firms that are really dependent on one insurer for their livelihood, but the lawyer with a good variety of insurance clients, they're not dependent on that one employer, that one insurer for their financial existence. Isn't that some kind of difference?
I mean, it's some kind of difference, but I think they're substantially dependent. And again, in this record, none of that's part of it. May I answer Justice Heck's question about whether the UPL issue is completely connected with this so-called issue of divided loyalties? It is not.
And, Professor, let me broaden that a little bit because I have a similar issue. Put the corporation, the entity, to the side for now. We're just talking about the lawyers. Once a person is licensed and is a practicing attorney in good standing in Texas, is UPLC concerned about conflicts of interest, breaches of fiduciary duty, any of those matters, once the lawyer is a practicing lawyer in Texas?
Does UPLC? It should not be, Your Honor. Our record in this case doesn't contain all the information that's contained in records in other cases, but it should not be. But the main point with respect to the one single case authority that is of most significance in this jurisdiction, the Hexford Title case, needs to be made. The pre-existing financial interest that the liability insurer has in the conduct of the defense, primarily the indemnity obligation, the primary obligation to which the defense obligation is collateral, precludes the application of Hexford to liability insurers in this context. That matter.
Restate that, Professor.
The fact that the liability insurers have a pre-existing financial interest in the outcome of the litigation, based on their indemnity obligation primarily, makes the use of staff counsel or any counsel to conduct the defense not the unauthorized practice of law. Insurers, like any corporation, can use lawyers inside or outside to protect their own financial interests. Hexford and its progeny say that. The Court of Appeals opinion explains that well, and that's a completely independent reason and a dispositive reason why this court should affirm the judgment of the Eastland Court of Appeals. With the court's permission,
let me ask you a question.
All right.
I think that's a good point. How is an insurance company, Travelers, for example, that has its own internal law department, how's that different from a corporation, say Cooper Industries, that is self-insured for $10 billion and has its own lawyers there defending its litigation. Is there any significant difference there?
Well, I'm assuming, Your Honor, that the lawyers working for Cooper Industries would be working for Cooper Industries in its own interest and in support of the financial and legal interests that Cooper Industries would have.
Right, defending its subsidiaries. But how is that any different from the unauthorized
practice? This is only a little bit different because you're looking after the interests of not only the liability insurer, but of the policyholder. But ethics opinions at least make it plain that you don't have to be looking out for just the interest that counts as a financial interest to eliminate the unauthorized practice of law. You could be looking out for the interest of one party and also of someone else with a common interest. Again, if we get down to a conflict, then the rules change. And
but
my co-counsel,
your analysis would be it's never the unauthorized practice of law. You may get into ethical issues that can be dealt with through the ethical guidelines on a case-by-case basis, but just fundamentally, it's never unauthorized practice of law.
That's what we think this court should hold. But the ethical questions always come up in.
But they would not drive the question of unauthorized practice.
They should not. But essentially, our main point is that the trial court was wrong in ruling that the use of staff counsel to represent policyholders is per se the unauthorized practice of law. And the Court of Appeals was right in correcting that mistake.
May it please the Court.
Mr. Wright.
Yes.
Petitioner claims, citing Matthew 6:24 in the New Testament, that man cannot serve two masters. And that's what we're asking staff counsel to do here. Do you agree?
When one takes scripture out of context, one can sometimes be misled. Our Lord said, you cannot serve God and mammon, which we know to be money. Those interests are always opposed to each other. The scripture says money is the root of all evil.
But just money versus money.
Just money. That's what this is about, defending the insured from a claim for money. So I do not think that scripture answers this question. I'd like to talk about three things.
Let me ask you first.
After just, I answer the question.
Professor Dorsenio says that there really isn't any difference. It might look that way, but that's misperception. But there is a difference, or we wouldn't be here, apropos the last round of comments, and that is that the insurers believe that it is efficient, cost-wise, to employ staff attorneys, at least in some contexts. How is that efficiency obtained, if not through control?
Well, the efficiency is obtained by paying a lawyer on a salary basis rather than on an hourly basis.
Why is that?
Why is that more efficient? Because you're taking the profit that the law firms make on charging younger lawyers out, for example, at $125 an hour, $200, or whatever they're able to charge. There's a profit motive for the law firm to be able to charge more for their associates than they pay their associates. And what an employer does who employs lawyers, whether it's Texaco or an insurance company, is they bring that in-house. They pay the lawyer whatever salary is agreed to by the parties. But the profit on that service, there is no profit on the service, basically. You take out the profit the law firm would have made by paying an associate a salary, which is obviously less than what you're collecting on that associate's time from the client.
But it seems to me that all, just to take a very simple economic model, which won't work, but all the profit goes to the lawyers, and the salary goes to the lawyer. So if that's the way it works and there's not somebody else out there getting profit, then it seems to me that the only way in a pure sense to get more or more efficient work out of a lawyer is to put constraints on him that he doesn't have in another setting.
Well, I think our record demonstrates to the contrary that there aren't the constraints and that the efficiency is obtained because these staff lawyers specialize many times in a certain kind of case. They have a lot of experience. They go to trial probably more frequently than lawyers even on the outside. But that's why I wanted to talk about control and stowers and reservations of rights in the time that I've been allotted. This record is very strong for us about control. And that's important because the UPLC convinced the trial judge to order this injunction based on the attorney being an employee of the company, not based on any actual control, but just over the right of control. UPLC has conceded at page 1 in their reply brief that the law does not support that. So now they go to the facts. But we've got them on the facts as well. The undisputed testimony, and nobody said to the trial court there was a fact issue. Catherine Woodruff, who was the American Home staff lawyer in Dallas, throughout my tenure, I was able to exercise independent judgment. The American International companies never interfered in my judgment. Travelers even has its people sign a statement that says, it's signed by Travelers and the staff lawyer, I will not permit the company to interfere in my professional judgment to my clients. I'd like to say something about the stowers if I've got some more time. This is a stealth issue. It was not raised in the trial court. The document is in the record, of course, but it was not raised until the Court of Appeals. Frank's casing makes it clear that it's very dangerous for an insurer to send a stowers letter, so-called stowers letter. I think we all know, precedent to that, you have to have the plaintiff make a demand within policy limits to trigger the Stowers obligation in the first place. Frank's casing says, you as the insured make a Stowers demand, i.e., please settle this case, you're risking having the carrier come back and collect reimbursement, and you won't be able to argue that the settlement was unreasonable.
But putting the decision on whether to Stowerize in the corporation's hands would seem to create a conflict of interest.
It would, but again, Justice O'Neill, you're stowerized when the plaintiff makes a proper demand. The defense lawyer doesn't have to say anything.
Well, then why the rule in the first place?
Well,
why does the corporation require come to us before you stowerize us?
Well, they're talking about in the circumstance, if you read the memo where there's been a mediation and there's no written letter from the plaintiff, but they made a demand orally in mediation, and then maybe we would have to write the letter. They send it up the chain. I think it's important to do that now in light of Frank's casing so you don't prejudice the insurer's right. But this case should not turn on a statement buried in an email that no witness was asked about and no point was made about in the trial court. They moved for summary judgment, as did we.
But just outside, I mean, it principally, if a corporation did require corporate permission or oversight before a Stowers letter could be written, you would agree that would be a conflict of interest.
That would be. I would hasten to point out, this is not corporate permission. This is permission from the man who's the head of the staff council operation, who himself is a staff lawyer, and bound by the same oath of fidelity to the insurers. So this is not going up to some, you know, executive in New York. This is going up to the head of the staff council. That's who is referenced in this email. I see my time has expired.
No issue left on attorney fees.
No, and I'm glad you raised that. It's moot. It's not that we have conceded that they're immune. I don't know anything about whether they're immune or not. We're just not seeking it, so that's moot.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, let me turn, if I could, to Hexter, because I think Hexter answers several questions that have been raised, Justice O'Neill, especially by you, Justice Wainwright, by you. And the issue in Hexter, at least their reading of Hexter, is that if there's a shared financial interest, the insurance company is really not necessarily a client. They say that one time, the Eastland Court of Appeals says that in its opinion. Then it says, of course, that the insurance company should be a client. But the real issue is the shared financial interest wasn't the turning point of Hexter. Never was. If you look at 952 of the opinion, and I must admit you've got to look at all this carefully, but at 952 of the opinion, the Supreme Court looked at what the defenses were raised by the title company there. Remember, in the title company, what they were doing was preparing title for customers all of whom were going to be customers for the purchase of title insurance hours, if maybe days later, that close. And the issue of, well, we have a shared financial interest, that's really not what it was. Under the statute existing at that time, 430A, there was a defense that was an affirmative defense, and the court reflects that, referring to the statutory defense, that was saying that if you work in the corporation's interest, then that would not be the unauthorized practice of law.
Well,
and what the Hector court did was go, Hexter court did rather, was go through that and say, factually, you don't meet that in any event, because the interest that you might have in ensuring good title is prospective, and also use the word contingent. Not my words, this court's words.
And Hexter was decided in 1944.
Yes, sir.
A few years after the committee was created, and
yes,
in the middle of the war in the bar over whether there should even be such a committee and if it should be directed at title companies, frankly. And I wonder how much we have to read it as a product of its of that milieu out of which it came.
Your Honor raises a good point. And it was during the birth of the issues related to the unauthorized practice of law. It had really begun in the 30s, and if you look, I think continued through the early 50s, and that's an excellent point. But the issue was, and I think that we do gain some vision there. Remember, Hexter is the basis of the Eastland Court of Appeals opinion. Their reading of Hexter is the basis of the nationwide opinion that is also pending before this court, and the Federal Court of Appeals, the Circuit Court of Appeals, in the nationwide case as well.
But
I think I'm sorry.
The insurance company does have an interest to protect here. I mean, that's clear.
Yes.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Wright or Mr. Dorsanio. What would be wrong with saying it's not the unauthorized practice? Just by definition, it's not. But to the extent there are conflicts, they can be dealt with through normal procedures of the state bar. Because it seems to me your position is always, when you have an employee, it is always the unauthorized practice of law.
Yes, Your Honor, we take that position.
And no other state has taken that position. Always.
Not true. Kentucky and South Carolina both do.
Under all circumstances.
Yes. But, Your Honor, my point to you is this.
North Carolina.
North Carolina. You're absolutely right. I never figured South and North, right? I would have been lost in the Civil War. You bring an excellent point, because one of the problems with Hexter for all of us is this. Hexter really turns, and if you look at 954 of the opinion, the decretal part of the opinion turns on the issue of divided loyalties and conflicts. And what Hexter said, I think, and I do think, Justice Heck, that Hexter does give us a lesson on that point now that is still very relevant. And here's what it said. The hallmark of the legal profession is absolute loyalty to a client that's undivided. The United States Supreme Court has recognized that in denying the accountant-client privilege, in
that,
saying
and
their
that's
differences.
True. As a broad statement, but even outside counsel face these same conflict questions.
To an extent, but not to the same extent. As Hexter said, when you have a divided loyalty, when you're employed by one and operate under their control, and you render legal services to a third person, you are doing it on behalf of a corporation. That's 954 and the ending passage of Hexter and the basis for that ruling.
So
and
you fall back important. On Matthew 6:24.
Yes, that's our Matthew. That's the layman's Matthew 6:24. Listen, what we're not saying here is that the divided loyalties are a danger for the public. I think in concept, all of us would agree with that. When we get to slicing it down about how far divided loyalties go and how much insurance and taxes are hurt, we get to different issues, which also deals with, and I can sense a question, so I'll stop.
Again, fundamentally, as I asked your opposing counsel, explain to me the authority that UPLC has to get involved in conflicts of interest breaches of fiduciary duty, and even lawyer advertising has been briefed. Once a lawyer is licensed and in good standing, isn't UPLC's job over?
Your Honor, it is to prevent the unauthorized practice of law. And let me also say, we talk a lot about harm here, the insurance companies having the brief. We are tasked with, at the committee, and again, I'm not a member, just representing the committee, with preventing the unauthorized practice of law. But in direct answer to your question, Hexter made sure, Hexter's unauthorized practice of law. It's no ethics opinion.
Right. Well, put the entity to the side, the corporate entity. We're just talking about the lawyers.
I'm sorry.
Put the entity to the side. Just talking about the lawyers.
And in terms of a lawyer, if a lawyer is aiding and abetting or practicing within a situation, that is the unauthorized practice of law by statute. That is also very specifically prohibited. Justice Medina, you raised an issue arising from your past in Cooper Industries. And the question is it any different? Yes, there's a world of difference. And in fact, Hexter recognized that. Somebody working inside a corporation, serving the corporation's interests, is not dealing in the unauthorized practice of law because they are the corporation representing the corporation. UPLC has never prosecuted that. Quick aside, there are thousands of lawyers, hundreds if not thousands of lawyers in Texas, not licensed, that are practicing for in-house for corporations, but not holding themselves out to the public, doing only work for the corporation. We don't prosecute that. There's no official rule on that one way or the other. Your board of law examiners also doesn't question that because they're dealing solely with the client.
Are you referring to foreign legal consultants?
No, I'm not referring to that. That is a different issue that is an exception that we have not had.
Okay, what hundreds of lawyers practicing in the boundaries of Texas for corporations are practicing and not licensed?
In-house counsel, for example, I hesitate to use one of my clients to make them a target, but there is a company in Fort Worth that employs a number of people that are FAA specialists that deal with regulatory issues.
And only federal issues, or are you talking about something different?
The federal and sometimes state that does them as well, but they're only representing the corporation, not appearing in court, but only representing the corporation, and they are, because they're employees, they are the corporation representing the corporation. That's what, in all 50 states, we have used as a justification for that practice.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.